water supply. Visit doseofrealitywi.gov.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, inviting you to join the symphony virtually via YouTube for a celebration of Polish cultural heritage Saturday, October 24th. Polish food and drink will be available for carryout from Ivanhoe Pub. More information is at racinesymphony.org. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning, and welcome to WGTD's Community Matters. My name is Laura Sumner Kuhn, and I'm your host this morning. And I'm very grateful to our guest this morning, David Hellman, who grew up in Racine, spent about a decade as a Kenosha County supervisor, and in the wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake in late August, began to speak out in very powerful ways that started to appear in social media and other media outlets. Given his very powerful message, I thought he would be an excellent guest this morning on our show, as we've been concentrating on recognizing racism. The first time that I've encountered David was when I saw a very lengthy video that was very powerful, generated by Milwaukee Independent. And the video had a title that said, Why Kenosha Happened. And it was a powerful message from both David and the Reverend Lisa Bates Froyland, who is the pastor at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Milwaukee. And then as I started to dig a little bit further, I saw a very interesting article in Mother Jones and a few other areas of social media and media in general where David started to emerge as a voice that we should really listen to. So with that beginning, I'd like to have you hear David himself. So David, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you find yourself doing these days?
So I was born in Chicago, and somewhere around the first grade, my family decided to move to Racine because my stepfather's job, he had gotten a job at the hospital there in the GI unit. So we moved to Racine. I graduated Racine Lutheran High School in 2003. And in the fall of 2003, started college at UW Parkside in Kenosha. And in January of 2004, moved to Kenosha and became acquainted with the Kenosha community. And was on the county board in spring of 2008. And departed the county board September of 2018 and moved to Milwaukee. Currently, I am the founder and music director of the Black String Triage Ensemble, a string orchestra that plays in the immediate aftermath of shootings and goes to sites of civil, quote unquote, civil unrest to try to use music to help keep the peace and hold off violence.
The ensemble is really a fascinating way to have a challenging yet peaceful presence in the midst of unrest, for lack of a better term, as you said. Following the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, you came back to Kenosha with the ensemble, didn't you? Could you tell us a little bit about what happened that day you came back?
So we only came to Kenosha one time, we being the Black String Triage Ensemble. And it wasn't something that I wanted to do, but it was something that I felt compelled to do. And we have two musicians inside of the Black String Triage Ensemble that have Kenosha ties. One who grew up there and graduated high school. And so it was something that I know that many of us felt like we needed to do. But my whole purpose and reason for creating the Black String Triage Ensemble was because my experiences in Kenosha were just so awful. I just needed something that was a repudiation of racism and hatred and homophobia and just all of the nasty that I experienced living in Kenosha.
And what happened that evening that you came to, I believe you came downtown to a park, right?
Yeah, so we came and in cars, we carpooled, and we came down about, I want to say maybe 7 or 8 of us. And we had one musician from Milwaukee, a white woman who's part of Legion of the Soul. Legion of the Soul is a separate string orchestra of non-Black, non-Latinx allies that we occasionally call upon to help us in some of the work that we do. So we have locally a viola player who lives in Kenosha joined us, a viola player who's a white woman from Milwaukee. She came down and met us in Kenosha. We had one of our Asian allies carpooled with us. So it wasn't just Triage, it was the Black String Triage Ensemble and Legion of the Soul. So we had some help. But we came down and set up right in front of the courthouse where the phalanx of officers in riot gear, sheriff's department, was lined up. And people were, it was a very strange atmosphere. It felt a little bit like a cookout. People had music and they were kind of mingling, and we set up and I could tell that something was going to go down. So we needed to set up quickly. We needed to start the music and hope that nothing horrible occurred. And we set up and we started playing, and the line of officers came out of the courthouse and people stopped what they were doing in the park and lined up to confront law enforcement. And I saw white supremacists wandering through the throng of mostly angry Black and brown people, but there were some angry white folks too. It was just a very strange scene.
What you describe from your experiences on the Kenosha County Board in that piece done by Milwaukee Independent doesn't sound as if your reaction or what the reaction or the circumstances that happened that evening in the park were very unanticipated. You lay out a pretty good argument in the video that was produced about how often people who are in positions of responsibility in our government have ignored what's been happening in Kenosha and places like Kenosha. Can you explain a little bit to our listeners about what you encountered during your decade as a Kenosha County supervisor and why Kenosha's chaos this summer and what promulgated it actually didn't necessarily surprise you?
Yeah. I recall coming home one day from a haircut. I would get my hair cut every 2 weeks on a regular basis at the same place. And I was coming down, I want to say it was Washington Boulevard. It was the 63rd Street Pick and Save, where the subway right there on the side. And I was passing by and I saw a Kenosha police squad face the wall of the subway, and the hood of the squad was up. And I was walking, and I just stopped for a minute, and I looked, and I said, that looks weird. Is the police officer having car trouble? Because the station's not too far away. I said, why would someone need to do that in the middle of the day? That just looks really odd. And I just kind of stood there for a minute trying to figure it out, and then I couldn't, so I just walked away and thought, okay, that's odd. Well, 2 weeks later, I see the exact same thing in the exact same spot. Only this time, I didn't just carry on about my business. I fixed my eyes on it as I kept walking. And as I was walking, my perspective on the scene shifted. And as I moved, I could see, yeah, the squad was still facing the wall of the subway. Yes, the hood was up. But as I moved, I could see that there was a black man up against the wall that the officer was searching. And it really doesn't matter what you think about police. It doesn't matter what you think about Black Lives Matter or black people in general. We have a constitution in this nation, and under Article 4 regarding illegal searches and seizures, that is a constitutional violation, a clear one. And any judge in this nation would uphold that. So I went and relayed this to some other folks who were elected and said, hey, this is what I saw today. What do we do about this? And what assurances do I have that this will never, ever happen again? I don't remember what was said to me specifically, but there wasn't at that point in time any kind of clear, this is where you go to report this, this is what we do about it, this is the procedure. There's none of that.
Can I just clarify a little bit? The violation that we're seeing is that the actual confrontation of the officer with whomever he was stopping wasn't in plain sight. With that,
right. The hood of the squad was being used to block the dash cam so that there was zero evidence as far as what the officer was doing.
I think that's a very important point, particularly these days, when we've seen that the exposure of police brutality among people of color has come mostly from everyday people who have taken the time to stop, record something, because we know that the devices that we think or have been lulled to think should show us that justice in fact is preserved for everybody through police cams and dash cams doesn't always happen, and we've had to augment that. One of the things that I've become aware of is the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, conducts classes for people to instruct them how to safely be recorders in instances where they think somebody's rights are being infringed upon. And so that, I'm just thinking, would be a perfect example of things that probably happen every day in our communities, where if we don't stop, as you did, to take in what's happening and surmise that somebody's rights are being infringed upon, we'll never hold people accountable to correct that. In hindsight now, David, what kinds of governmental roles actions should happen to prevent things like that, that didn't at the time that you saw this?
I personally, because it happened in my district, it's the kind of thing that you as a person in public office should be able to prevent from happening to the people that you are elected to serve, whether they voted for you or not. You're there to care for everybody. And so, you know, if I like lock yourself in the mayor's office and demand a meeting with the mayor and the police chief. And if you don't get one, say you're not leaving the building. Because that's not necessarily a single officer's decision to do that. That's indicative of a culture of the department.
So in other words, we should be examining if, as first of all, citizens in the community, but also especially if you're in an elected position in local government, you should be examining traffic stops. You should be examining when and how people are stopped and who is being stopped, and what kind of protection they have to ensure that everything is conducted with their right to freedom and liberty and fair treatment under the law is being preserved, correct? What kinds of things could they be asking of their government that we haven't yet strongly enough?
There needs to be monitoring on a daily basis. I'll give an example just real quick from here in Milwaukee. With the pandemic, with the Safer at Home order, Mayor Barrett gave additional powers to his police department to enforce the law. Okay, that's fine. We understand that from a public health perspective, but it should not be the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service that comes along and tells you 2 or 3 months later that the overwhelming majority of tickets under Safer at Home that your police department wrote went to Black and brown people that live in poor communities. You're the mayor. You have a whole bevy, a whole host of people who work for you, where you should be monitoring this in real time on a day-to-day basis so that you can see in the data that there's something here that doesn't match up, so that you can see that there's something disproportionately occurring and work to address it. And I don't understand somebody who's a mayor, a county executive, or a governor who looks the other way in those matters, but then will tell you in public or in private that they care and they're also concerned. I don't understand that.
As a Kenosha County board supervisor, did you know what kind of training at that time? Now you left, you said in 2018, did you know what kind of training at that time the Sheriff's Department had to have in order to be a sworn officer for the department?
I'll be honest and say no. I had a very frightening encounter actually with the Sheriff's Department just prior to my departure from Kenosha. One of the things I had tried to do before leaving Kenosha County was I had a printed copy of the police department policies and procedures. And I had gone to the Sheriff's Department and asked them if they would print out for me the Sheriff's Department policies and procedures, which details all of that, use of force, and so I went in to pick up the documents because I had gotten a phone call from the Sheriff's Department that they were ready. So I walk in the building, go to the Sheriff's Department area, speak to the person behind the glass. I'm County Supervisor Holman. I'm here to pick up some documents. And she says, just a minute. And so a sheriff's deputy comes out who sees me, recognizes me, knows who I am. Yes, Supervisor Holman, we have what you requested. I'll be out with it in a minute. And he goes behind the door. A different sheriff's deputy comes out and he's talking to somebody over his shoulder. The door closes, his head turns, and he sees me. And all I'm doing is sitting in a chair. I've got my elbows on my knees and my chin is in my hands and I'm looking at the floor. And the sheriff's deputy takes a very aggressive stance and a loud tone and says, well, what do we have here? And I just look up at him just confused. And I said, I'm just here to pick up some documents. And I have friends that are in law enforcement and they have told me that there are levels of force that you can show. And the first level of force that you can exhibit is body posture. And so here I have a sheriff's deputy has got his feet spread apart and his hands on his hips, raising his voice at me, and all he did is see me. And that's alarming in and of itself, but what makes it deeply troubling is that he's doing this inside of the sheriff's department, inside of the public safety building, which is one of the most secure buildings that we have in Kenosha County, housing the IT department and 911 operations and emergency management. So why are you being hostile inside the station house, and all you've done is lay your eyes upon a young Black person who in reality, because he has budgetary authority as a county board supervisor, is technically your boss?
And if they venture to do those things in public view, what happens outside of that purview would be?
You have no safety in private. You have no assurances. You have no constitutional rights. And your humanity is eviscerated without you even being able to understand it.
I think that there are many people who live in southeastern Wisconsin who are gaining a new understanding of what life is like for people of color if they have not experienced any of these things. And I think one of the things that is so horrifying to me, you also address in the video that addresses why this happened in Kenosha. And one of the things is the infiltration of white supremacist organizations or would-be white supremacists in the state. And we've just had a frightening example of some of that kind of white militia activity in the attempted kidnapping of Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer earlier this month. But one of the things you pointed out, well, there are two salient points that you make in the video. And one is that, you know, Kenosha has a history of having been a sundown community, a community where people of color were invited to work during the day, but then walked to the border and expected to leave by the time evening fell. Other is the idea that we have the Kenosha Guard and other kinds of organizations and militia that seem to align themselves with white supremacist organizations. And you speak of the skinhead triangle that seems to have emerged from activities that people have watched from afar in Kenosha, Antioch, where the young man, Kyle Rittenhouse, who is being detained right now for shooting two people after the Jacob Blake protests in August, lives in Antioch, and Waukegan. What can you tell me of your experience as a Kenosha County supervisor and what knowledge Kenosha County supervisors might have of these kinds of organizations in the community?
I certainly remember walking through the city of Kenosha fairly extensively. I didn't have a car for much of the time that I lived there, so I either took the bus or I walked. And there's definitely one bar in particular inside of an urban area that brings in bands, and some of those bands are white supremacist bands. And I found that out because a friend of mine who is into different genres of music, she told me, and she helped me understand why it was this particular bar that I would pass by so frequently, why it is that sometimes outside of that bar, I would see crowds of white folks that just would stop and stare at me in a very unsettling fashion. You can gain a lot of information in just a look, and still, I don't know how else to explain it. The folks elected in Kenosha, many of them are people who've been in that community a while. Many of them had been in Kenosha much longer than I had. I mean, I showed up in 04 and was elected in 2008. I didn't go to high school there. I didn't spend my childhood there. So, and I didn't have family that lived there. So my roots were not as deep as the other people around me, both on the county board and both on the city council. And I say that to mean this: people around me knew and just chose not to be honest about it and chose to look the other way. And so I don't know what else to say other than there's an obligation on you in public office when you know these things to be honest about it and say, this is here, this has been here. And part of that admission also has to be the fact that because you have had that knowledge and have withheld it and haven't done anything about it, then it means that you've coddled it. I had a professor who said, what you permit, you promote. And she was 100% correct when she said that. What you permit, you promote.
So what kind of actions can somebody who's elected to either the city government or county government in either Racine or Kenosha do in order to protect their communities from hate groups infiltrating the everyday lives of people and intimidating people? What kinds of actions could they actually have taken? Have you thought about that, having been a past supervisor? What could have the county board have done to prevent a rise in hate actions and intimidations by these groups?
The Kenosha County Board of Supervisors was given an opportunity by me to pass a resolution denouncing racism and Islamophobia, and they didn't want to do that. So I would say governing bodies speak in laws. In the case of county boards and city councils, that's ordinances and resolutions. In the case of state legislatures and Congress, that's resolutions and bills. So you use those to denounce things that you as a governing body of so-called leaders, and I say so-called leaders for a reason, use that to denounce this. But then you have to take the additional step of having town halls. You need to be engaging with the school district and finding ways to talk to parents and talk to teachers and talk to principals so that this kind of infection doesn't get into your teenagers and into your children and start to spread. That's really the kind of aggressive action that has to be taken. And you can only do that by leading. And I say so-called leaders because every single day I was elected, this idea of political leader, well, you can only be a leader if you decide to take action and decide to step forward. If you're always worried about re-election or what somebody else is thinking, and looking over your shoulder while staying silent, that's not being a leader. That's not helping anybody.
And in reality, as human beings, we all need to stand up and be accountable for either our actions or our lack of actions. One of the things that you've said in some of these public interviews that you've had really resonated with me in it. You said we can't afford to have pretenders, in other words, we can't afford to have people who pretend to stand for civil rights, who pretend to stand for racial justice and equity for all. We can't have people who are silent and know these things happen in their governments, in their schools, in their neighborhoods, because there are real haters out there who are continuing to take action. So from a personal standpoint, what can people do and engage in now from your experience on the county board that will make a difference in how our governments step up to lead? What can the everyday person do to ensure things change?
I think making sure that you have very intense conversations with your close friends, with your acquaintances, with your family members, both immediate and extended, on what they're thinking and feeling and why, is absolutely vital. I think maybe it really boils down to this question of how do you view other people as being family? Ma familia, how extensive is it? It's not just the people who live in your house. It's not just the folks across the street. It's not just your coworker who's, you know, people say, I have my work wife, I have my work husband. Like, it's not just them. It's every single person that you come across. And to realize that and to feel that and to act on it is a challenge every second of every single day. But if you do it, you build community, you build a network, you build an appreciation and an understanding that rivals anything else. You just have to want to know and to want to love and to push people to try to do that. Cornel West has a phrase where he summarizes the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, justice is what love looks like in public. And I think that's got to be the guiding light for everyone. Justice is what love looks like in public. So it doesn't matter how comfortable you are or are not with somebody who's transgender. Do you really want them to be beaten up and mutilated just because they're trans? It doesn't really matter what your prejudicial assumptions are about Black and brown people. Do you really think that someone deserves to have their children ripped from them and held in cages? There just has to be a certain level of love that leads to an ethos of compassion that compels you to act no matter who the person is. Their life condition has to matter.
I think that's really important advice, particularly at this time, because there is still so much to fall out of the incident of the Jacob Blake shooting in Kenosha earlier this summer. More decisions that everyone seems to be awaiting on what happens from that incident. And I fear that unless we take steps to start healing as a community and building up community now and understanding now, we might see more tearing apart of the Kenosha community when decisions are announced. What kinds of things publicly do you think we could do in these days as impending decisions are still awaited for?
From a citizen perspective, I don't mean to keep stuttering. It's difficult to talk about. I really feel like the only way that progress can actually be made in Kenosha in the wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake is if people in public office are honest about the past history. And that obligation does not fall to the people of color who are on the city council or county board. That obligation falls to their white colleagues. And until that happens, there will never be any true pathway to any kind of wholeness. It will always be fractured and destroyed as a community. There will be no real healing until the legacy of what Kenosha has been and currently is confronted and owned up to. And I just, you know, I had one of the members of the city council call me and say, the mayor keeps saying over and over again, no, we couldn't foresee this. We couldn't foresee this. And I said, well, that's just a straight up lie. And I keep harping on that because if you are a young person of color and you're thinking of running for office and you go to these folks who are, in many cases, seasoned political veterans. I mean, these are folks that are 50, 60 years old. They've been elected a long time and in some cases, different offices. They'll be the first ones to tell you, well, you know, you're a person of color, so you're going to have some challenges. Okay, what are those challenges and what do they look like? They might begin to name a few, but they can't tell you everything. But the point is that they know. They know. They know their community intimately, but are dishonest about what the history has been and what it is in the present. And that's just got to stop. I mean, citizens can do a lot in terms of promoting change and should, but I question the longevity of that. I question how there's a difference between what can be cosmetic and what can be deeply structural that moves a community in a different direction. And so that admission is required. That admission is required for serious, deep, long-lasting structural change that accommodates what citizens want to see.
And then I think to your point, we need to raise up a whole new collection of people who are interested, young people who are interested in leading a community toward justice and running for elected office. You were probably a great exception for a person even who at 20, when you were 23, when you ran for county board, that even ventures into the political realm at that age, so that we could have more diverse, younger voices infiltrating that historic voice that has been dominant. Is that something that you've seen starting to happen at all in Kenosha? Are there groups that are looking at understanding local politics and how to insert themselves into steering local communities into a more just direction?
I would, from what I've noticed at somewhat of a distance now, I would say no. And the reason is because Kenosha does not want its young people. And this is something that UW Extension with Kenosha County made very apparent when I was on the county board, that young people do not feel valued. They don't feel like they have a stake. They don't feel like they have a place. There's a reason that the kids call it Kenoware. And so why would you want to be elected in a place that you know does not want you and has made no provisions for you to be able to have any kind of a future? Why would you stay there? Why would you stick around to work to improve it? You wouldn't. So that's something that, and to an extent, I mean, Jim Cruiser knows that and understands that, the county executive of Kenosha, but hasn't done much to try to change that. John Antaramian, the mayor of Kenosha, knows that. He seemed like he wanted to try to change it. There was an initiative that he launched in conversation with the director of the public library, Barbara Bratton, who is just absolutely stupendous of a person. And he said, I noticed that the events that you have in the summer, there's never any violence. The events that you have in the park, what can we do to help further that, to help replicate that and incorporate more young people so that they feel valued? So she put together a team of people to sort of work through those questions and figure out something. And I was on that as well as a handful of others. And we had gotten to the point that we figured out pretty much what needed to happen. And the mayor basically lost interest. He had just was like, all right, that's great. Thanks. Bye. You know, and moved on to something else completely different. So, you know, what young person would stay in a community when you know that that community doesn't want you? Why would you be there? You wouldn't.
Yeah, you leave us with a lot to ponder, David, and much of it unsettling about what we aren't doing to really help our communities flourish for everyone. I can appreciate your turn to music for solace in the times of trouble that we experience, and I wish you could tell us just a little bit more in these last couple of minutes of our time together this morning about what the Triage Ensemble plays and its mission.
The Black String Triage Ensemble, like I said before, is a group of Black and Latinx string players. They're not for hire. They don't do collaborations. They specifically make the decision to volunteer their time to show up to shootings and play in the immediate aftermath. They only play composers of African and Latin descent. And it's a string orchestra, but they don't show up and play classical. They play spirituals. They play jazz. They play blues. They play soul. They play reggae. They play tango. They play folk music. And they also do some classical. And so in a triage concert, there's six pieces of music in accordance with the five stages of grief, going from denial all the way to acceptance. But I have thrown in a sixth stage of grief, being faith, because if we don't believe a situation is going to get better, then we don't move forward. And so the work of the Black String Triage Ensemble is really focused in the immediate aftermath of shootings, meaning within a span of no more than 2 to 2.5 hours after the event has occurred, of helping people come to grips with what's happened and not have it be something that hardens them. And really, you shouldn't have to go to bed with that being the last thing on your mind. The peacekeeping work that we do, which is basically what we did in Kenosha, that's different than a triage concert. In those situations, we recognize that something has occurred and that what we're really aiming to do is to use the music to hold off violence from occurring as long as possible. And when the violence does break out, whether it is tear gas canisters like we experienced in Kenosha, or residents angry at law enforcement throwing water bottles, we play as long as we can until it gets to be too dangerous for us, too dangerous for our instruments, and then we leave.
Well, I appreciate your peacekeeping efforts, your wisdom, and your fortitude in trying to get us all to see how we need to stand together to make a more just and peaceful world for everyone. I thank you for your time this morning. I'm sad to say that it has come to time where we need to say goodbye, but I hope we'll be able to connect again. I'm sure our listeners have learned a great deal this morning. So thank you, David, and stay well.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.